welcome to Esoterics Podcast. You can't eat the sunshine for the month of February 2017, and we're back from hiatus. Join us this month as Alan Hess, architect and architectural historian, walks us through his Palos Verdes Art Center exhibition on Aaron G. Green's mid-century modern organic architecture. We'll also visit with land use consultant Bill Christopher, principal at Urban Concepts, for a deep dive into Wilshire Boulevard development history. So stay tuned.
Can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long lost neighborhood called Herbina between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast for the month of February 2017. Our podcast is titled You Can't Eat the Sunshine, and we're very happy to be back after a little hiatus, which I'm happy is over. So, Kim, do you want to just, before we even get into the details, just say hi?
Hi, we're back. You know, the hiatus wasn't really planned. It just, you know, we hiated, and then the next thing we knew, we were working on a million other things, and months went by, but we're back, and it's beautiful. And did you miss us? We missed you.
Guidebook, Kim. It's all about the guidebook. Okay. So, here we are. It's February 2017, and our guests this week for this month's, our guests this month for this episode are Alan Hess. He's an architect and he's an historian, and we've gone to interview him on the opening night of the show he curated at the Palos Verdes Art Center about the organic architect Aaron Green. It's a great show. It's a great interview. Alan's a great guy. This is shamelessly in conjunction with a bus tour we are giving on April 8th as part of our 10-year anniversary. This bus tour is called Palos Verdes Ancient and Modern, and one of the stops is going to be at this exhibit that Alan curated at the Palos Verdes Art Center. We're going to do a walkthrough, and it's just, we'll get into this later. But anyway, super excited. It's a great interview, and we're kicking off our promotion of this tour and this exhibit with this podcast. Our second interview for this month, our second interview, is Bill Christopher. Bill Christopher is principal at Urban Concepts, an architecture and land use consulting firm. Bill Christopher. So this is a really great podcast because Alan Hess is an utter genius, as is Bill Christopher. Bill Christopher's interview on Wilshire, we're going to talk about Wilshire Boulevard, and it's really good. He's really been in the trenches for decades, and he's just going to tell us everything you wanted to know about transit and density and history and zoning and the park mile plan. I'm so happy. We did this just at the beginning, just at the end of last year, and I just can't wait that we're starting off the new year with this interview. So that said, Kim, the tip jar, you are the Pishka Maven.
I haven't asked for anything in a while. Hey, guys. You know the drill. We do this podcast. It's free. We run all around Southern California talking to these amazing people. And if you dig it and you'd like to support what we do, your donations, contributions are always welcome. They're not obligatory in any way. But if you're so inclined, chip in. We will spend your money gladly on chili relleno burritos, gasoline, and other good things out on the road. Thanks. And thanks for listening.
Perfect. Okay, so lest we forget, that the podcast is neatly divided into three sections, the first section of which we're in, and the first section has several parts. The third part we're in, we're now in the closely watched train section, so named after my favorite Czechoslovakian New Wave film about Nazis and resistance fighters. And so, Kim, let's get started. We ended the year with Alan Hess at a meeting where we found out that Oni Group, who just purchased the purchased Times Mirror Square, the Los Angeles Times and its parent company, Times Mirror Corp's headquarters, Broadway, Spring, 1st to 2nd, Oni Group just purchased this from Tribune, and they announced to us their plans to demolish the William Purr 1973 edition in order to build giant mixed-use towers. So that was December 10th.
Yeah, we kind of saw it coming, but the question was always, are they going to find a way to save the Pereira, which is a fairly low-rise building, several stories high, important late modern contribution by William Pereira, this incredibly important, underappreciated Southern California architect and city planner whose work is just in grave peril all across the Southland. We're looking at so many important Pereira structures and complexes that are facing demolition or massive alteration. So we, you know, really hoped that they would find a way to keep the Pereira as perhaps the base of a tower, but that's not what they want to do. And it raises a lot of really troubling questions about the adjacent structures. The notion of preserving the Art Deco building, the Gordon Kaufman building, which is kitty corner to City Hall, which is kind of the iconic LA Times. Well, if you demolish the Pereira to build a tower, you're actually ripping off integral structures that have been woven by Pereira into the Kaufman building. So what a lot of interesting trouble we're making when we try to build high-rises where existing landmarks stand.
Yeah, this is going to be very interesting. Yeah, so this is a closely watched train. And so we will continue to keep you appraised. Okay, last week was very exciting. We were looking at an afternoon of really mundane, trivial, necessary errands downtown. And we get an email as I'm lacing my boots up and looking for my smartphone.
You really should lace your boots and not check your email at the same time, because you almost fell over when you saw what Lisa Napoli sent us, which was a picture of the absence of Calvin Hamilton, former LA city planner and one of the most important people in the development of the public policy program, which is historic preservation in LA, going back to the 1960s. Calvin Hamilton's honorary plaque, not memorial, it was actually erected when he left city service while he was still alive, on the Bunker Hill pedways, which were his idea. Someone pried it up and walked away with it. And Lisa Napoli, our writer-journalist friend, was very upset. And she sent us this, and she said, well, I noticed it was loose a week ago, and I let the BID know, and maybe the Business Improvement District, came and took it for safekeeping, I hope. And Richard and I had a little discussion.
We didn't have a discussion. I told you to start writing a blog post. And I of course, called Donald Spivak. And Donald, of course, said, don't push this through social media until we get some answers. I'm sure it's fine. And I said,
well, we both said, hey, if it's out there and someone's going to melt it down, we kind of need to get the word out so that when the guy at the metal shop buys it and then Googles Calvin Hamilton, he gets something that says this is an important city landmark. So we put it out, and come to find out, fascinatingly enough, the BID was aware of...
Oh, I get to tell that, because I found... Yeah, so I get to tell that part.
Okay, but I get to tell the part about what happened.
Okay, but
no,
but,
I'm not going to let you do it, because you keep...
I did it. I had the emails of the top three people at the Downtown Central BID right there at the top of my address book, and I emailed them, and 5 minutes later, Brian got back to me and said, everything is fine.
Right, but...
And I did that.
Yes, you did. And it's good you got an answer back. But the reason I'm not going to let you tell the rest of the story is you might think from that, oh, the BID did go and scoop it up. They pried it loose. It was partially loose, and they finished the job. No. We don't know exactly what happened, but yes, some transient person who collects metal bits for some reason or another.
Scrap?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't talked to this person. Maybe they're obsessed with Calvin Hamilton as we are and wish to take him home. Well, that's possible, too. This person did remove it and had it And someone who lives on Bunker Hill got it away from them. I don't know how. Someday we will know. But the happy fact is, this resident let the bid know they had it, and the bid made an arrangement with the city that they could reinstall it. And sure enough, it's been glued back down again. There's some chips in the bricks surrounding it. You can definitely tell someone went at it. But Cal is back up on the pedways, and you can go and visit him, and I recommend that you do. And when you do, tell him you hope he had a good adventure and to stay put, because he should stay put. He's an important Angeleno, and we like to go up there and kind of ask what would Calvin Hamilton do and let him know we're still thinking of him. I'm certainly kind of sad to see just a patch of peeled up adhesive where our friend used to be. So happy news in the end.
I'm really happy it's back, and I'm so grateful to Brian at the bit that the DC bid that he took care of it so quickly. But he suggested that there might be a ceremony, and there wasn't. They just put it back, and I wanted a ceremony.
Yeah, but it's kind of embarrassing because they did have a heads up that it was loose, and
okay,
they.
We're glad it's back. So Calvin Hamilton, we bring this up today because Bill Christopher's interview, which is, this is like one of the best interviews I've ever done on this podcast. Okay, it's fantastic. I think we've been trying to schedule an interview with him for like 9 months. So Calvin Hamilton is really important to my Bill Christopher interview because Calvin Hamilton, city planner, 1964 to 1984 or 86, whatever. He writes these series of reports called Centropolis, and Centropolis is this notion that Los Angeles consists of 36 hubs with really this shrinking downtown. And so that's how Los Angeles planning is guided as a bureaucratic abstraction and a policy direction. But what we're going to talk about at the very beginning of our interview with Bill Christopher is that in 1988, after city planning under Calvin's direction since 64 had started gathering gathering information and putting into databases, they started to pull everything together and build maps, rudimentary GSI. And what they really found once they started building all of these maps was Los Angeles, despite what Calvin Hamilton thinks, and despite what the abstraction of Los Angeles is, a city with 36 nodes, which each have their own community plan. Los Angeles is a linear city, and we're going to get into that at the very beginning of the Bill Christopher interview, and I think it's very important. So thanks for helping me with all of this, Kim, with Kyle Hamilton. It's really great.
Oh, sure. It was kind of exciting. I mean, I loved having a treasure hunt, and especially having, you know, all the worry go away in 5 minutes thanks to you having everyone's email address. So it went pretty well in the end. But we did go out and do our errands as planned, and we left the blog post up just saying, where's this missing city planner? Just to let people get, you know, a little bit of the sense of horror that we had. And then we updated it and said everything's fine. And now if you visit the blog post, and we'll include the link here in the podcast notes, you can actually see the missing plaque and the returned plaque. Again, thanks to Lisa Napoli, who's been documenting it with photos.
And if anyone ever thought that the pedestrian walkways off of Flower and Figueroa could be that interesting, they are. All right, Kim, just a couple more closely watched trains. We made a list, a top must keep track of list from LA Magazine this past week.
Yeah, that was a nice surprise. They put out a list of the 50 must-follow Twitter feeds in LA, and we were on there.
Did we increase our subscription?
Yeah. We got some more bunch of more Twitter followers, which is nice. And
the Calvin Hamilton plaque is stolen.
Yeah, well, well, I mean, they specifically called out that we put pictures of our tours on Twitter, which we do, but mostly I link to articles on Twitter. For pictures of the tours, you should really follow us on Instagram. I actually send out live pictures and sometimes even videos from the road. But it was an honor. And they said that we were the most interesting bus tour in Los Angeles. Noted that Los Angeles has a lot of bus tours, so that's saying something. And that was really a sweet thing. And there are a lot of great people on that list as well, so we'll link to that as well. And if you're on the Twitter, you could do worse than follow some of those other great people who are listed there with us. Thanks, LA.
My mother is going to enable a Twitter client on her iPhone. so she can follow us, because she doesn't really understand what, my mother doesn't understand what social media is, but now that we're mentioned in LA Magazine, yeah, she's gonna install a Twitter client.
Well, LA's been really very good to us lately, because they also called us in that David Kippen piece about Bob Winter. You were called an indispensable Los Angelist, which is a pretty great neologism on David Kippen's part. So, you know, your mother loves opening up LA Magazine and reading about you. And I guess we're going to love opening up our Twitter client and getting lots of at mentions from your mother that don't really make a lot of sense. And we'll just send smiley faces back.
I can guarantee you with near certainty that my mother will never start to use Twitter. My mother will never, no, my mother will never start to use hashtags or push tweets through. No, she's just going to, yeah. We'll keep you posted. Kim, one last thing. It's already February. I know. I don't know how that happened. It's already February. What is 2017 for us as a bus tour company and public policy think tank?
Is that what we are?
I've decided that I'm now going to refer to myself as a public policy think tank. Yeah.
Yeah, just one guy in the tank. You know, it's 10 years ago in May that we started doing this in earnest and rolled out the esoteric brand with all of the tours that we had written in a fever pitch, because you and I were both absolutely convinced that when other people saw what a great idea it was to do these incredibly complicated, deep, research-driven, intellectual, demanding, you know, college course on the road bus tours, that other people would do it and that they would, you know, steal all our good ideas. So we had to launch with all of the tours.
Right, which, of course, all of which as background required us having been obsessed, raised and obsessed with Los Angeles our entire life. So bringing, you know, like 20 years of really unfocused passion to it.
And if we could see those little youngsters 10 years ago with their little tour company, we would laugh and say, "You think you know Los Angeles? Oh, ye silly little creatures." Now we kind of know LA. But 10 years into it, we got to celebrate a little. I like 10th anniversaries. 10th anniversaries are dangerous, though, because the last time I did a big 10th anniversary something, it was the summer of 2001. And I was rolling towards 10 years of Scram Magazine, my unpopular culture and music zine. And I decided to put on a giant festival called the Scramorama at the Palace Theater in downtown L.A., 2 days of offbeat music, booked some of my favorite artists of all time. It was very much the manifestation of the dream show I would have wanted to see. And I ended up putting on this incredible two-day show right after 9/11. Somehow broke even. Would have made more money if the guy manning the beer counter wasn't giving free beers to all his friends. And kind of, that was sort of the end of Scram being super exciting for me. I don't think that's going to happen with Esoteric, though, because there's two of us, and okay, we're still having a ton of fun.
We're done, Kim. Okay. That's really, like, we're fine.
I'm just saying I'm a little superstitious. 10 years is intense, but it's still really fun. And I was going to say, we have a bunch of really special things planned for this 10th anniversary. It's not a single event, and it's not after 9/11. It's after the election of Donald Trump. What the hell is going on here?
So so we have a lot of stuff coming up, Kim, in this year. And we're going to get to that when we start talking about some upcoming bus tours. Let's get, which we're going to do now. All right. So the goal of the podcast in 2017 is to make a seamless transition from closely watched trains to upcoming events. And by that, I mean, it's just like we're talking about 10 year anniversary. So one of the important, the first 10 year anniversary special one-off bus tour for Esoteric is next Saturday.
It is, and it's 2 days in South L.A.
The title is 2 days in South L.A.
The title, that's what I meant.
People might have thought we meant we were driving around South L.A. for 2 days.
That's a really great idea. Can we do that next? It's a bus tour about 2 days in South LA, specifically about the Symbionese Liberation Army, the revolutionary group that kidnapped Patricia Hearst, the heiress of the newspaper fortune, and went on a rampage and on the run throughout Northern and then Southern California, culminating in this terrible shootout. One of the first SWAT operations that came into public consciousness, live televised shootout and firefight at this house down in South LA. And I don't want to encourage you to get too excited because the tour is sold out. We are doing a waiting list for it, though. Brad Schreiber, the author of Revolution's End, is our special host. Not really the co-host, he's the host. We're his aides and assistants on this tour. And, you know, get on the waiting list if this sounds interesting, because the more people who are on, we'll see if we can get you on or maybe do it again. But that's a really nice kind of start off for the 10th anniversary, to have a sold-out guest-hosted tour and do something brand new. But at the same time, you know, we really did start out going down into South LA and going to that SLA site on our earliest pre-esoteric tours. So I'm glad to be going back again and seeing that tree, which is still bullet-riddled opposite the lot where the house used to be.
So what did you see on social media that someone posted when we announced the tour? They wish they could do that. They've always wanted to do this tour. They've always wanted to write and host a tour like this.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the thing, though. I mean, anybody can. All of these great ideas are right there. If you want to just, like, go park your car at the corner of Hollywood and Vine and yell, "Hey, SLA, tour starting right now."
Don't do that. Okay. So, Kim, we have a bunch of stuff coming up. The end of this month is, of course, the Lava Sunday Salons, which we took off for November and December, thank goodness. Got some work done, got some rest. The monthly Lava Sunday Salons are back. February's is Poem Noir. Poet Suzanne Lummis, granddaughter of Charles Fletcher Lummis, is going to be hosted and tell us all about it, Kim.
It's our second Suzanne Lummis Poem Noir Salon presentation, and the first one was just utterly amazing. Suzanne has developed this genre of poetry that is deeply inspired by film noir and Southern California darkness and crime, and she's going to bring out an all-star crew of actors and poets to present not only original poem noir compositions, but also some hard-boiled fiction readings, some film noir monologues. It's just going to be dark, dark, dark. And all of these Sunday salons now are two-part events, single reservation. They're free, but you do have to RSVP. And they are followed by some sort of walking tour. We're not going to walk too far. And the next one, we'll be heading over towards the Bradbury Building, maybe other places, so don't come late. And continue.
No, definitely other places.
Definitely other places? Oh,
yeah,
I love it. Yeah, we're all going to be on the move.
Yeah, we're...
Well, we can't torture those poor guards at the Bradbury Building. I mean, how much do they like poetry? Maybe a lot. We'll find out. So sign up. Suzanne is terrific. She's got such a wonderful crew of poets that she works with, and they're all really inspired by this terrific genre of the hard-boiled and film noir, as we all are. So let's see what they've got in store for us. I'm sure it'll be chilling and nightmarish.
Great. Okay, let's keep going. So let's see. That's February 26th. March... So March is kind of slow for special events. That's okay. We're gaining momentum. March 26th, our Sunday, monthly Sunday salon is going to be called Making Sense of Parker Center. That's again Sunday, March 26th, much like February was the 26th. We're going to start in Grand Central Market in the basement, as we do. We're going to have some slides and tell us what we're going to talk about and what we're going to do once we're done with the slides in the intro talk.
Yeah, we're going to be focusing on this really important Welton Beckett Modernist Building, which is one of the best buildings owned by the city of Los Angeles. It's Parker Center, the glass house, the old police administration building, and it's in the crosshairs. The city wants to knock it down and build a new office compound there. They've gotten a lot of support from Little Tokyo by offering Little Tokyo business organizations 1,100 parking spaces. Little Tokyo has a really strong negative feeling about this structure anyway, because it was the destruction of about a third of the Little Tokyo neighborhood by eminent domain to build it in the first place in the mid-1950s. So some people, you know, are saying now bring it down, but other people who care about mid-century design are saying this is a very important Wilton Beckett structure. It's an important part of the Civic Center. It has beautiful integrated landscaping and art. And maybe it should be given a chance, or parts of it ought to be adaptively reused. That's what the Conservancy believes. That's what the the CHC, the Cultural Heritage Commission, believes, even to the point of writing op-eds for the LA Times. And it's what we believe. So we're going to, you know, try to understand the building. I know it's not a hugely popular building, sort of like the Pereira LA Times. A lot of folks feel that negative impression of all of the LAPD violence that was, you know, headquartered there and the protests that happened. That's all part of it, too. But you can't really erase the past. And sometimes you have a great building worth hanging on to with a charged and negative history. And you have to work that out. So that's what we're going to do. And you've also forgotten we're going to be doing a talk at the LA Breakfast Club.
Oh, my gosh. I totally forgot.
Yeah. And that's an early event
March 29.
29? Okay. Yeah, we'll get that in there, too. We'll put a link. We're going to be at the Breakfast Club, which has been operating breakfast cultural presentations and networking for about 75 years, right over there by the Mulholland Fountain at the LA River and the bottom of Griffith Park. There'll be some calisthenics. There'll be a buffet breakfast. And Richard and I are going to talk about weird LA history and what we do. So maybe we'll see you there. I understand first-time visitors get a free breakfast.
Really? That's pretty cool. I want to mention, though, before we get off the topic of Parker Center, because I don't know where else to say this, you were reading me a bunch of stuff out of social media and other sources about hearings they're having about whether to demolish it or not, save it or not, and Yukio Kararatani, a former planner for the Community Redevelopment of Los Angeles, the person basically responsible for the day-to-day implementation of the Bunker Hill redevelopment project, testified correctly that Parker Center took out a large part of Little Tokyo. But I just found it ironic that the man who was responsible for played a large hand on the day-to-day operations of the largest federally funded wholesale demolition of a neighborhood in the country. You know, the irony did not escape me.
It's probably just as well we weren't at that hearing. I don't know if we could have controlled ourselves.
Well, of course we could have controlled ourselves, but the irony would not have escaped us. So, let's see.
Yukio has a lot of karma to work out.
Oh, he does.
Oh, Yukio has a lot of karma. Yeah, I know. I know he does. Crime Lab. We've got a Crime Lab coming up. April 23rd. And this is relevant because, of course, Brad Schreiber, who's giving the Symbionese Liberation Army Patty Hearst bus tour next week, is also going to be one of the speakers at the Crime Lab. He's going to talk about his book, Death in Paradise. And the second speaker is going to be our good friend, Professor Donald Johnson, talking about equivocal death and testing knife wounds for semen and all this great stuff that comes from how you learn to read a crime scene after you've been, you know, a forensic investigator and examiner for 20 plus years. This is going to be a lot of fun.
I'll be there. It sounds terrific.
Okay. So I think we're ready. I'm going to flip the page here. We're going to set up the interviews. Okay. So we have two interviews today, Alan Hess and Bill Christopher. Alan Hess's interview about the Aaron Green Organic Architecture exhibit, which he curated and which is going to be part of our April 8th, Palos Verdes bus. Oh, we didn't talk about the bus tour. Let's talk about that for a second. April 8th, we have a Palos Verdes bus tour. We're going back to the peninsula. Title is Palos Verdes Ancient and Modern. We're gonna stop at Peck Park and Friendship Park in San Pedro, the southern tip of the Palos Verdes Peninsula. And our friend Daniel is going to talk about prehistoric agricultural civilizations which were on the peninsula, which confound any accepted notions of human habitation in the area. It's going to be fantastic. Then we're going to, in this bus tour, Alan's going to be on the bus. Then we're going to go look at some mid-century modern houses on the Palisades Peninsula. Our friend Price Morgan is going to take us through the Seaview track, which is Paul Williams, very important architect. We have other surprises in store on this tour that we just can't publish because they're gelling. And then we're going to go to the exhibit that Alan curated on Aaron Green, and he'll walk us through.
We're going to go to the Aaron Green house, right? The Anderson.
Maybe.
Maybe?
I can't. Okay. Can't say it in print. Okay. Okay. We're probably going to the Aaron Green house. Okay. The Anderson house. It'll be okay.
You never tell me anything unless we're doing a podcast and I make a mistake. Boy, is my face red.
It's okay. So then we're going to go to Malaga Cove Plaza, and Ann Hugh is going to meet us, and we're going to talk about the fountain and the Del Portal building and the Garnier building. And this is just this beautiful 1926 piazza that Ann Hugh had a huge hand in restoring. It's fantastic. And our last stop, we're going to stop at the Palos Verdes Library District's Central Library in the History Room, and Monique Tsujimoto, the archivist for the Palos Verdes Library District, is going to walk us through the archives so you can go and research all this totally awesome stuff about the Palos Verdes Peninsula and architecture that is waiting for you to discover you never knew anything about, and she's going to have an architecture exhibit.
And someday, someone who takes one of these tours with us is actually going to write that amazing book about marine land based on all the archival marine land stuff out on the peninsula.
Yes, and we'll talk about that too at the lunch break, because that's where we're going to... Okay, all right, so now I think we're ready to introduce the interviews. So Alan Hess is our first interview, so we'll introduce him second. Bill Christopher is our second interview, so I'll introduce him first. Okay, so Bill Christopher. Things I know about Bill Christopher. He is a principal at Urban Concepts, an architecture and land use consulting firm. He's in that really totally awesome Durrell Stone building on Wilshire near Oxford. That's so amazing.
The curved ones with all the hanging pendular lights and the piercing. Ooh, and it's even better when you go upstairs.
Yeah, it's such a great building. So we're going to interview him. He's our principal at Urban Concepts, architecture, land use consulting firm. He is former president of the Board of Neighborhood Commissioners for the City of Los Angeles. He was a really core person to the creation of the neighborhood councils. Really, really someone that was really at root, just making this happen. And he also is a former member of the Los Angeles Planning Commission. So he's incredibly well qualified to talk about transit and zoning and overlay zones and historic districts and density and art and international architecture competitions and all of that. So it's going to be a fantastic interview. Please stay tuned for it. Our first interview, which we'll segue into right now, Alan Hess. He's very talented. He's completely engaging. We love working with him. Kim and I went down and interviewed him opening night at the Aaron Green exhibit at the Palos Verdes Art Center. This is an exhibit about Aaron Green, the organic architect. Aaron Green was one of the few architects that directly worked under Frank Lloyd Wright in his office, and it's obvious from his work. And so we'll just come up to speed on this exhibit, which is going to be one of the cornerstones of our April 8th bus tour. And so let's take it away with my interview with Alan Hess. I'm here with you. We're at the Palos Verdes Arts Center, and I need you to properly introduce yourself and tell us the occasion for our visit to this place.
Okay, I'm an architect and historian, and have written a number of books, and we are here today at the opening of the exhibit at the Palos Verdes Arts Center on Aaron Green, who was an associate of Frank Lloyd Wright, worked with Frank Lloyd Wright on many of his most important projects in the last decade or so of his life, 20 years of his life. But he also had his own independent career. And that's what this exhibit is for. This is the first exhibit in at least 25 years on Aaron Green. He is one of those unknown, unheralded architects that we need to know more about. And so discovering these treasures in his archives and in his work is part of the purpose of this show.
Fantastic. So before we're going to walk in and you're going to show us around so people get excited. What kind of... Were there any great eureka moments? I mean, the show looks great, but was there anything that... What was the most interesting thing for you, discovery, sort of nuance that wasn't obvious?
Well, the main thing, which I had a hint at but did not realize, is that Aaron Green worked here in Southern California for 5 years at the beginning of his career, 1946 to 1951. He is primarily known as a Northern California architect because that's where he worked with Wright.
Yep.
He had an office with Wright. He was Wright's associate and really the only associate in an independent office that Wright ever had. So that shows you how Wright respected Aaron Green very, very much.
Perfect. All right. Well, let's walk in and let's just sort of go through some of these highlights.
Okay.
And oh, today is the 21st of January, so the show obviously opens today.
Yeah.
And it runs through May.
It runs through May 28th, 2017. So there's plenty of time to come down here and see it.
All right. Perfect. Let's jump on in and let's go pick. Go pick a table, and
okay,
let's start talking.
Start at the center.
Okay.
These are drawings of a house that Aaron Green designed here in Los Angeles, in the Hollywood Hills, in 1954 for Farley Granger, the movie actor, and his partner James Mitchell as well. Now, what we have here are two distinct designs. One is one story, the other is two stories, and includes a mezzanine balcony bedroom, basically. But what these gorgeous drawings show is that Aaron Green really met the needs of his clients. He was flexible. If they needed something, he would change a design. We often get this idea, unfortunately, because of the model of Howard Roark, the imaginary architect that Ayn Rand came up with. You get the idea that organic architects were all, imperious and insisted that clients live the way that the architect desired. This shows that the facts are quite different, that he was quite flexible. Can I talk a little bit about the drawings?
Yeah.
Again, these are hand-drawn drawings.
They're gorgeous.
Plans and perspective rendering. The colors. Notice the colors as well. This is a colored pencil. But they're rich, natural colors. Greens, purples, browns. And, of course, the house is set in this beautiful, natural setting. Nature and combining nature and architecture was always paramount with most organic architects, and Aaron Green in particular.
Do you want to just jump out of this narrative and give us a definition of organic architecture, which I was going to save to the end, but I think we're ready just to get one from you.
Sure. Organic architecture is modern architecture. It was for the 20th century. It was designed for, used and responded to modern ways of living, including suburban life, and modern technology, new engineering, new materials, etc., right up to the date in using new materials. Just like all modern, that's all modern architecture. What distinguishes organic architecture is this concern for nature, living in harmony with nature, living with the beauty of nature. And, of course, Frank Lloyd Wright was probably the best-known organic architect in the 20th century. And that was, he always capitalized nature, capital N, because he considered nature as God, basically. And that's how much he really respected nature, and that man needed to live in harmony with nature. It's interesting because this is kind of really the roots of our concern today for sustainability, using resources wisely, et cetera, et cetera.
Good definition. Let's keep moving. Pick another wall, pick another table. Let's go.
Well, let's go over here.
Okay.
This wall really defines organic architecture through photographs of Aaron Green's houses.
Okay, wait, before you start, describe this wall. It's a 3x4 grid.
3x5, actually, yes. 15 photos of 5 individual houses, but these show how the house set in the landscape and is surrounded by nature. It shows how the spaces, through the use of usually of triangulated geometries, interesting geometries, spaces inside flowed. One room flowed into the next and then outside to the patio. Natural materials, stone, wood, brick, are exposed and used for their natural texture and color and so forth, again, to relate the inhabitant to nature. Built-ins, built-in sofas, built-in counters, built-in tables, etc., so that the house was an integral design. Really, organic architecture, I mean, the ultimate organic design is a tree.
Yeah, right.
A tree is one thing. It's unified. But the roots, the trunk, the branches, the leaves, the flowers are all very distinct and serving their function. And yet they all work together harmoniously in a unified design. And that's what these houses do.
Are any of these... So I want to get to the Marin Civic Center in a second, but are these photographs any famous, outstanding examples of Green's architecture? It's okay if the
answer
is no.
Outstanding examples.
But they are all outstanding.
Famous, because this is the thing. He wasn't as well known, certainly here in Southern California, and yet he participated in this period. You think, you know, after World War II, think of the people working here, Neutra and John Lautner and Welton Beckett and William Pereira and Pierre Koenig. All of these great, great architects with their inspired sort of design. Aaron Green, at the beginning of that period, was part of it. And these houses really are at the same level of quality of any of those more famous Southern California designs.
Perfect. Behind you, there's a Marin County Civic poster for the Marin County Civic Center.
Yes.
Let's. I think this is the most iconic. This is a very iconic building, so let's put it in the context of the show.
Yeah. Well, of course, part of the show is about Aaron Green's work directly with Frank Lloyd Wright on, as I said, some of the most visionary products of Wright's mind in the last 10 years of his career. And he died at, you know, how old was he, 89, 90 years old. It was a little bit more than that, actually. He kind of fudged his birth date sometimes. But he lived a long and prosperous life. The Marin County Civic Center was one of these visionary ideas which actually got built. It's standing there in Marin County. It was the Civic Center. It is the library, the administrative offices, the courthouse, the jail, the post office, fairgrounds. It was an entire... I really see it as the capital building of Broad Acre City. Broad Acre City was Frank Lloyd Wright's vision for what the American city should be, living in harmony with nature, decentralized, combining low-rise and high-rise, etc. And we have this one great example of that vision of the American city. And now, it was designed in the late 50s. Aaron Green was instrumental in getting the commission for Frank Lloyd Wright, but and was designed when Wright died in 1959.
Oh.
And it started construction. Yeah, it started construction in 1960. But again, Frank Lloyd Wright trusted Aaron Green to complete the vision. So it was built in phases from 1960 and the basic part finished in 1969. And Aaron Green oversaw that, made sure that Frank Lloyd Wright's idea was maintained through all those years. And it's just a great building.
It's a great site. I know.
This is a poster that was designed for an exhibit a number of years ago. It was designed by Aaron Green and his son Alan Green, and it's signed by them.
Hey, I'm gonna just bump you out of this. I think we're gonna meet you at another civic center by a master builder soon. William Pereira, Santa Fe Springs Civic Center.
Yeah.
Give us compare contrast.
Well, these are all buildings from the 1950s and 1960s when suburbia was growing. And suburbia was not just this random hodgepodge of development. It was planned, and it was planned according to new principles of urban design. And so, of course, with all these new cities, they needed a civic center. And so quite a number of really good architects designed these suburban civic centers. Smith and Williams designed Buena Park's civic center. Pereira did that one. Becca did the City of Orange and its civic center. And, you know, probably the Marin County Civic Center is the granddaddy of them all. It's so expansive.
Perfect. Okay, let's wrap this up. Show us one last thing for this interview. Bring us on home.
Okay. Let's do Marin City here. Marin City.
What are we looking at? We're looking at a large reproduction
of a drawing of Marin City, which was affordable housing in Marin County.
Right.
It's in Sausalito, basically. Sausalito, you know, was a shipbuilding center during World War II. Large African American population was settled in that area.
Devil's Island, yes.
Yeah. And so after the war, they were just living in temporary housing. So the county and the federal government wanted a permanent affordable housing project for that population. And Aaron Green was selected. And what's interesting about this is, again, how it has the same qualities of organic architecture. There are quite, I don't know, there's six or eight multi-story buildings, but they grow gradually out of the natural contour of the land. And then there are these lower two-story units as well. It was designed, incidentally, with John Carl Wernicke and Lawrence Halprin, the landscape architect.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so high quality, which is interesting because after it was built, and this is around 1960 or so, some congressman in Washington complained that such luxurious, good design was being given to poor people. And, in fact, the project came in under budget. So, you know, there was no question of being extravagant in it. But this congressman, who didn't quite understand what architecture was all about, complained that anybody would have decent, livable, light-filled, nature-connected architecture to live in. But it's still there, still works, still beautiful.
It's fantastic. Okay. You did it. So the exhibit opens today, January 21, and it runs through May
28th.
Tell people one great thing to look for in this exhibit. Your favorite thing, because you just.
Well, probably my favorite is this small sketch over here under glass. It is the initial design sketch for the Farley Granger House, the one we saw earlier and fully developed. But this shows the architect scribbling and doodling and figuring things out in a very rough way. So you get close to the mind of the designer. So I like that a lot.
Alan, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Richard.
My name is Elaine, and I'm here in Amy's Castle in Lake Elsinore. And you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Bill, I'm here with you in your office. I love this. This is the Durrell Stone building on Wilshire. I love this building. Bill, we're in your office. We're in a conference room of your office. We're looking at this great map from 1988 of the city of Los Angeles, which is huge. I want you to describe this map and why its inception was so important and the role you played in bringing it about?
Oh,
and first introduce your, I'm sorry, first tell us your name and your title.
I'm Bill Christopher. I'm a principal with Urban Concepts, an architectural and land use consulting firm here in L.A. And among other things, I'm a former member of the L.A. City Planning Commission and former president of the Board of Neighborhood Commissioners for the city.
Perfect. Great. Thank you. All right. This great map, you had a big role in it. Let's go.
Well, we're looking at the generalized planned land use map for the city of Los Angeles, which was created back in 1988. Prior to that time, the city was beginning to experiment with GIS, or geographic information systems, in computerized land use. And they had put together 35 community plans in their computer, but they'd never bothered to stitch them together into one plan for the entire city. At the time, most people in the city talked about the centers concept, which was something that Cal Hamilton had proposed in the 1960s, and looked to sort of concentrate development in the city around 30 different locations in the city as centers. When we put together the actual land use for the city, we found something entirely different. We found that the city of LA is, in fact, a very linear city. It follows many, many major corridors, both Ventura Boulevard, Wilshire Boulevard, follows Avalon Boulevard, and others along the spines of the city. And you see them on the map as basically red lines, where you have continuous linear retail or commercial development stretching from downtown to the ocean, or to West Hills in the valley, or to the harbor in various parts of the city.
Atlantic to the Pacific, right?
Atlantic to the Pacific, yes, almost.
Okay, so good. So I want to jump directly. I want to take this abstract idea of a linear city, and I want to put us just a little east of here. We're on Wilshire Boulevard. I want to put us, it's 1925. We're in MacArthur Park. Wilshire Boulevard has just split through MacArthur Park, and looking west, it's Frontier. So give us, paint us a picture. Let's start with Bullock's Wilshire, and let's look ahead to A.W. Ross, and let's just start ticking through some ideas and some years here.
Well, you had the beginnings of the movement from the city center to the west toward the ocean, and you had the first sort of manifestation of that being Bullock's Wilshire and sort of the townhouse buildings across the way, or some of the other sort of brick apartment buildings that began, that fairly high mid-rise buildings in the same area. That began a trend of development moving west that at the same time, by the time you got out to Fairfax, you were sort of in the hinterlands. You were in an area that had an airfield and a race car stadium at the time. So it was definitely an undeveloped situation. And you looked from the teens and in the early 20s, basically it was an oil field.
Right.
That stretched from Bunker Hill, or from Crown Hill, all the way to the beach in Santa Monica. Nothing but a sea of oil derricks. And it began its transition from an oil field to basically residential and commercial development as those patterns moved in the 20s and 30s. Both west and north at the same time, infilling the area between downtown and Hollywood, and beginning to stretch out west. The visionaries of the march out Wilshire Boulevard were a man called A.W. Ross and another man called Gaylord Wilshire. And between the two of them, they developed ideas in how to develop commercial buildings along a linear strip. And particularly, Mr. Ross is famous for developing the Miracle Mile.
Right.
And the Miracle Mile in the 20s and 30s began as a series of two-story commercial buildings with central towers. That, if you look at the Desmond's Building today and a couple of others that remain, they're a long, low-rise building with a central vertical element, much like you could also see that across the street from here at the Wiltern Theater.
Yeah.
that are in a similar type of development pattern. And what Mr. Ross's innovation was that he would take the land behind the commercial building and turn it into parking. So what you had was a commercial frontage along the boulevard, and then you had sort of acres of parking behind. So it was the first commercial strip developed devoted to automobile access.
I'm gonna interrupt you and just prove that this is an abstraction, not just a specific go to Pacific Boulevard in Southgate. Exact same thing. Yeah. Exact same thing.
But that was the sort of the model, and then that same development pattern occurred to some extent to the east between MacArthur Park and Vermont and Normandy, and to Western here as example by the Wiltern Theater. And then you had an interim piece in that area was what's now called the Park Mile. And it was an area that was all under a single ownership for the most part, which was ultimately gifted to the Archdiocese of Los Angeles and had very little development over the intervening years from the 30s through the 60s primarily. And then, as the Archdiocese needed money or for other reasons, began to sell off the parcels or look at developing those parcels. And at the same time, then the Hancock Park Homeowners Association and the Windsor Square Homeowners Association took a very strong interest in how the Park Mile would be developed, since it was very much an underdeveloped piece of a missing linkage between essentially the Miracle Mile and the more developed parcels to the east.
Right.
So the upshot was what we call the Park Mile Specific Plan, which came into being, I think, in the late 80s, mid-80s, actually, probably.
John Ferraro was the council member for this district that was one of the people that helped make this happen.
Yeah, John responded to the needs and desires of the Hancock Park folk and the Windsor Square folk and basically came up with a plan which is essentially a three-story development limit or height limit in most of the Park Mile combined with setbacks and landscaping requirements that produce essentially the park-like setting which the mile provides today.
Perfect. And recently, there has been a change of ownership of not only the Scottish Rite Temple there, but the insurance building across the street. And so this is a plan whose teeth and whose foundations are being questioned. Would you agree?
Well, the Scottish Rite Temple has been in play for probably a dozen years now.
Okay.
And the Scottish Rite folks themselves were looking for ways to basically convert the building to revenue that they needed in other locations since they had a declining membership in that area. There have been several attempts to repurpose the building until the current one currently has taken hold to make it basically a museum piece for a private collection. But the Scottish Rite itself has within it an 1,800-seat auditorium,
yeah,
which very few people know about or sense what's actually in there. And if you were to use an 1,800-seat auditorium in a reasonable way, it would generate a lot of traffic and other impacts in the surrounding community. So hopefully the museum use will temper that to some extent, but it is in fact a resource that is underutilized or has been rarely utilized throughout its lifetime. Yeah.
Fantastic. Before we get too much farther west, I just want to step back for a second. You promised me we could talk about spot zoning, and we'd start with the idea that zoning was invented one night in 1946 in Los Angeles and hasn't changed. So with that statement, will you explain how that puts us on the ground on Wilshire Boulevard at some point in the 1930s?
What you have is a zoning pattern that, well, I should say, before 1946, zoning was sort of an organic system in the city of L.A. that grew up basically to respond to needs in various parts of town. It really wasn't organized into a formal zoning code or zoning map until 1946, when much of the city, the central city, was zoned, and the entire San Fernando Valley was basically zoned at the same time. And that zoning pattern has remained on the books relatively untouched through today. There have been efforts along the way to modify it or to change it in various forms, but the basic tenets of it are played out in the map we talked about earlier, where you see the long lines of, yeah, of retail commercial development along all of the major boulevards in the city of L.A., and infill housing behind. Either the closer to the boulevards you are, the central city, the higher the density of the residential development being. Now, spot zoning occurs in the city of L.A. in any number of ways. Primarily, it responds to requests for zone changes or plan amendments that go along with modern development or new development, and then each individual property is conditioned to a specific set of requirements for its own location, which don't apply to the property next door or the property down the block. So, in effect, you're getting spot zoning through that process. But that process, because the city is such a large entity, 440 square miles, which, depending on who's counting, it's much larger and much harder to manage than other cities might be. And managing on a parcel-by-parcel basis is almost impossible to do at that scale. So the default position is that if somebody wants to develop their property, they come to the city and ask for permission to do certain things.
Right.
And because you have a one-size-fits-all zoning code, effectively, which doesn't really fit all of the parcels or very many of the parcels around the city.
Perfect. So let's then jump into the notion of transit oriented development, which, because I've interviewed people like Tom Rothman a number of times through this podcast, everyone listening who's been a longtime listener knows that transit is a new paradigm for planning in Los Angeles. So let's put us at Wilshire in Vermont, and let's just start talking about development around that metro station. And then we'll backtrack to the original metro plan, but I just want to put us on the ground at Vermont and now.
Well, the metro rail itself, or heavy rail transit in Los Angeles, is something that is different than the city has grown up with, essentially. One of the things that I learned in my early years in planning in L.A. is that transit in L.A. is not about moving traffic faster. It won't do that effectively. What it is about is adding capacity to the system. Where you have a downtown core in Los Angeles, which is limited by its access by the various freeway system we have, and if you reach capacity on the freeway system, there's not a whole lot of way to get more people into downtown to densify or increase development in the downtown area. So the biggest boost to that is to add a subway line, which, if the capacity of the subway line is equal to about 20 freeway lanes. So instead of adding 20 lanes to the local freeway system, you add one heavy rail transit system, and you get the same amount of capacity coming and going. The only way to make that system work is you have to make it as a two-way system. It has to take people from downtown or from outlying areas who arrive by train to outerlying areas of the city through either heavy rail, light rail, or other means of distributing them into the grid. And one of those ways is by the heavy rail line coming out to Vermont. And the Metro Agency itself, or Metropolitan Transit Agency, has been very good about, are very focused, actually, on developing the area around their station so that they create the two-way traffic in their system. So they have people who are coming to that location, and they have people at that location going downtown.
Yeah.
And by getting people moving in both directions on their system, they get the ridership numbers up high enough that they can attract the federal aid from Washington that they need to build the system. So it's all tied together. And what you get at Wilshire in Vermont is some fairly high-density apartment complexes that have changed the nature of that intersection by creating more walkability, by putting more people on the street, by providing transit access, which is basically the transit-oriented development that or TODs that the planning department is trying to encourage through the guidelines that are in place for the area around the stations.
Perfect. In our outline that we put together for this, you said there's some interesting problems with buildings and back around that. Would you mind? Let's just jump into that. Yeah.
What you get though are some conflicts between the high rise buildings that front on Wilshire and on Vermont, and some of the old 1930s apartment buildings that are left behind on the backside of the development. And it's not always an easy transition between the two. You have, in that situation, very large parking structures which flank existing apartment buildings. So you have apartment buildings that sort of looked into parking structures, as opposed to the sort of in the old days, where the apartment building looked into apartment building. Now it's just you have the noise and activity that's associated with a parking garage across the way from your building.
Perfect. Okay, let's just jump in. I love this term, scenic byway, and the original metro line. We're just talking about the current metro line, but back in the day, I remember, you remember, methane explosion, scenic byways. Let's go.
Well, the Wilshire Boulevard is designated as a scenic byway, but that really doesn't have a whole lot of teeth in the planning situations you have today. Under CEQA, you're required to analyze certain issues that come along with that, but it doesn't really affect or dramatically change the ability of people to develop along the boulevard itself. One of the things you relate to is the original plan for Metrorail, which originally came from downtown, went to Fairfax, and then turned north into Hollywood, which was a political a series of political decisions made to serve certain constituencies at the time, and wasn't a particularly effective means of mass transit, because if you were in North Hollywood and you had to get to downtown, you had to go via Wilshire and Fairfax, which
right.
was sort of counterintuitive at the time.
And still is counterintuitive, yeah.
One of the benefits of the explosion at the Ross department store was...
Would you please give us a date on the methane explosion?
I don't know. I don't remember what the date was. I believe it was in...
84.
And that rerouted the metro rail train because Congressman Waxman decided that there was now a no-dig zone or methane zone around the LACMA Museum area, around the tar pits, basically, that said you can't you can't dig in that area.
Kim has just confirmed it's 85. 85 was the methane explosion at the Ross, and so you get a no-dig zone around LACMA.
Right. And one of the outgrowths of that was the first round of MTAs, or at the time the RTD, their first pass was, well, we're going to come out of the ground on Wilshire at Normandy and go overhead from there to Fairfax. And then continue on west if we need to. So there was going to be an elevated train coming down the middle of Wilshire Boulevard.
Oh, my God. God bless you for fighting that.
from Normandy to Wilshire. And one of the things that at the time, I was an activist in the Wilshire area, and we were adamantly opposed to having an elevated train with the station boxes at the time were huge. Because if you, in the old days when you had an L, you had a fairly benign little station area on top of the tracks. Today's version of that are just enormous. They have everything up in there, from restaurants to ticketing booths to everything else that you can imagine, and the box just becomes like a three-story box sitting up in the middle of the air, up in the air in the middle of Wilshire Boulevard, about 50 to 60 feet wide, and we felt that this was just this was a no-go for the scenic byway that, that was in the Wilshire Boulevard was going to be. So, fortunately, we were able to stop the MTA from pursuing that path.
I love it. I'm gonna ask you a question. We haven't talked about this, so it's okay if you don't know the answer. This is on the topic of Donald Spivak, right? I love Donald Spivak. So thanks to Donald, I know a lot more about the LACTC, the Los Angeles County Transit Commission, Los Angeles County Transit Commission. So I guess, and I, you bring this up, so we were talking about original Metro Plan. So RTD, the Rapid Transit District, was charged with this initial light rail, and that that wasn't working. So I guess so. There's this creation of the LACTC.
Well, the CTC was a funding mechanism more than anything else. The RTD was charged with building the system. They were the contractors for, or they were basically the designers and implementing the construction of the subway system. The CTC was the became the funding mechanism by which the money flowed from Washington and Sacramento into the system. And ultimately, the two were combined into what we call today the MTA.
Yeah. Thank you. That helps the Garfield entry. Okay, we're at Fairfax. We're at Wilshire and Fairfax. It's tar. It's a racetrack. We're now. Why don't we start with today? And we've got what you correctly describe as a very distinct architectural corner. And there's talk of making it even more distinct. So why don't you give us right? Why don't you give us a weather report, and we'll look back and then look ahead.
Well. Fairfax is the western terminus of the Miracle Mile, and the mile was built in basically around three different things: the May Company store at Wilshire and Fairfax, across the street, which was then the Orbach department store, was also built, but a little bit later, after the May Company. The May Company was designed by A.C. Martin and Company, and is one of the icons of the city of L.A. Later, there was also a Coulter's department store, later the Broadway, at Wilshire and Hauser. They formed sort of the nucleus of the retail portion of the mile to the west. To the east were some the older sort of the two-story with central tower buildings lined the mile going toward La Brea.
The Dominguez building, one of my underrated building on Wilshire.
Yes. So what you had was those pieces, and along came the Metropolitan or the County Art Museum. And the Art Museum happened in the 60s as being sort of in Hancock Park, which Hancock Park was set up to basically showcase the tar pits or encompass the tar pits themselves. So the county, as sort of owners of the Hancock Park area, decided that would be a great location for the County Art Museum. And that began what sort of the genesis of what later was attempted to be Museum Row on the Miracle Mile. And a number of attempts have been made over the years to develop the museum. The Hardy Holtzman Pfeiffer wing was added to the front of the museum, and then a Japanese pavilion was added along the way, and finally the museum acquired the May Company itself to complete the campus that they had, and that the interesting transaction that occurred to allow that to happen is represented by all of the low-rise development around Park La Brea. The May Company portion, the 5-acre site, which was the May Company itself, was part of a parcel or part of land acquired by Forest City Dillon at one point, which basically controlled the out parcels around the perimeter of Park La Brea. So in exchange for allowing the development or the height around the Park La Brea, the Forest City donated or agreed to sell the May Company to LACMA at the time.
Wow. Wow, so all those, all that development on 6th, basically all along 6th Street and just east.
And some along a couple of the other portions as well. But yes, that's all part of, was all part of the sort of the quid pro quo for allowing the May Company to be acquired by the museum.
I love it. Let's just jump into it today. We've got the Peterson and we've got, well, it is happening now. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has taken a lease out on the May Company building and is building a theater. Let's just jump into this. Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing between the Peterson, which has undergone, which is the former Auerbach department store, and has undergone a complete facade replacement or upgrade to become what I think will be eventually an icon in the city of L.A. A lot of people have a very negative reaction to the red racing stripes.
That would be me.
I don't really have that kind of a reaction. I think it's trying to be an icon and probably will be over time because it's something different. Like a lot of other things in Los Angeles are different, many of which have been lost to history. But we have some new ones coming up, and that one is one of them. And across the street behind the May Company, you also have a sort of a an illuminated sphere, which has become the auditorium and other portions of the Hollywood Academy Museum. And between the development of that and the development of the Peterson, you have a very interesting architectural corner that which sort of bookend the May Company itself. And that's something that you don't really see in other parts, in anywhere else in Los Angeles, where you have those kinds of iconic developments clustered in one location. And then you have the potential future development of the museum itself.
Thank you.
Which has had fits and starts over the last 10 or 15 years, and now seems to be focusing on a single idea to replace much of the museum campus with a sort of amorphous platform that will serve to house the museum's exhibits, which in effect will cross Wilshire Boulevard and land on a parcel of land at Wilshire and Spalding that the museum has owned for many, many years. And we've always expected to be developed in some fashion. This may not be the one that was thought about, but it will be interesting to watch how that program evolves from today to whatever construction actually occurs at some point in the future.
Perfect. Okay, let's wrap this up. You're fantastic. You're incredibly knowledgeable. We really appreciate it. You mentioned something as an aside just as we were putting this outline together, and I really liked it. You mentioned the notion of preservation being used as a hammer. Let's just end on that. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you have today, you have a much more active preservation community in Los Angeles than has been the case in years past. One of the things that the community is undertaking is something called Survey LA. Mm-hmm. And Survey LA is going around sort of tagging buildings as potentially being historic or have some historic aspect to them. And what you get sometimes is folks who look at something and think that there may be some historic context there, that Charlie Chaplin may have slept there at some point in his career, and he apparently slept in most buildings in Los Angeles. what happens when you go to start to look at redevelopment opportunities in certain locations, you wind up having to go through a preservation argument for something that may or may not have any preservation merit. I am adamantly in favor of preserving the things in Los Angeles that make the city or that provide the city's history or speak to the city's history. But there are a lot of pieces that are, in my opinion, that sort of get tagged that way that may not have the same level of historic interest that the real thing does. And it's I look to the community itself to say, you know, which are real and which are not, and to not so and to focus on the ones that are, and not necessarily use the sort of peripheral or tangential tagging that some buildings may have as a hammer against future development.
Perfect. Give us your hopes and your dreams for Wilshire Boulevard. You've fought so hard and thought so much about the street for so long. What do you want to see?
It's hard to say what the city of LA will be in 2050. Which is
it really is, isn't it?
And that's sort of the horizon line that I look at today, sitting here in 2016, as to what form will the city take when you have driverless cars, when you have you have more transit, you have a different density calculation than you have today, potentially, where density is not as vilified as it is in the current climate. I would hope that the city might embrace more in the way of height. We seem to be in a situation where anything tall is bad. And I'm not sure why that is, because the trade-off should always be height for open space. And one of the things that the city needs is open space. And what I always tell people to look at is look at the juxtaposition of the original Park La Brea development versus the new stuff that was put up in the 90s or in the 2000s. And the older Park La Brea buildings are 18-story apartment buildings, and they have two-story studio or patio buildings around them, and they have large tracts of open space. If you look at the four-story wood stick buildings that went up in their around their perimeters, they are held to the four-story limit. They are packed in to the point where there is no open space around any of the buildings, and you have units that look into each other 20 feet away. Right. And I ask people to say, well, which one is better? Is it better to have tall buildings which have great views from them, or an open space, or to have shorter buildings which are more densely packed? I think some of the resistance to density has more to do with the packing of the density in smaller areas or in lower areas than if it were to be relieved in some ways by adding greater height.
That's fantastic. You did it. You did it. I want to thank you, and let's get you to sign off, and we're gonna call it a day. You knocked it out of the park.
Well, thank you, Richard and Kim. I enjoyed the experience, and look forward to future conversations.
My name's Dan Fonte, and we are in Los Angeles 90066, also known as Mar Vista, California, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
And we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our latest podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the month of February 2017. Our guests were Alan Hess. He's an architect and an historian, and he talked to us about the exhibit he curated about Aaron Green at the Palos Verdes Arts Center, and its focus was Aaron Green and organic architecture. And it's part of our upcoming Palos Verdes bus tour on April 8th, too. We also spoke with Bill Christopher. He's a principal at Urban Concepts, an architecture and land use consulting firm. And we talked to him about Wilshire Boulevard, just everything you ever wanted to know about Wilshire Boulevard. And it was totally amazing. We want to hear from you. The feedback loop is very important to us. So, Kim, can you begin to tell us about that feedback loop?
There are so many ways that you can reach out to us. Of course, you can send us an email, youcanteatthesunshine@gmail.com, or use the contact link on www.esoteric.com. If you happen to be on Twitter, because you started following us because you read about it in LA Magazine, you can tweet at Esoteric. You can rate the show on iTunes. It always is appreciated when folks do that because it helps other people find the show. And generally, we just love to hear from you. If you happen to get on the bus and you're a podcast listener, let us know. We like that too.
Perfect. Okay, Kim. So, upcoming tours. This is the part of the podcast as we roll, as we begin to say goodbye, say goodnight, thank everyone for listening, stay tuned, keep signed up, subscribe. You start to tell us about some upcoming bus tours in the immediate future, so please take it away.
Okie doke. Well, it's coming Saturday. We have a sold-out event called 2 Days in South L.A., the 1974 SLA Shootout with author Brad Schreiber. There's a waiting list on that, so sign up if you're interested, and maybe we'll do it again, or maybe even be able to squeeze you on. The following Saturday, we're getting into the California Culture Series with Boyle Heights and Monterey Park, the hidden histories of L.A.'s melting pot. A tour, wow, it seems so timely, about how important it is to have immigrants who keep our neighborhoods lively and full of good food and young, energetic people who are really excited to be here and become Angelenos. So we'll look at about 100 years of immigration from the Boyle Heights neighborhood and how political activism passed from the Jewish to the Chicano communities, and then we'll go out to Monterey Park and look at how some really interesting changes in the federal law in the 1960s resulted in mass immigration from the Far East Asian continent, which brought us the new Chinatowns and some really beautiful 1920s locations along the way, because Monterey Park wasn't always the new Chinatown. It used to be Little Italy, among other things. The following Saturday, we're on the crime bus. It'll be Weird West Adams on Saturday the 25th. We'll be going down and exploring some really beautiful sites where terrible things happened. We'll walk through Rosedale Cemetery and visit the King and Queen of Malibu, the Ringes. We'll talk about cults and creeps and Scientologists. Not that those are cults or creeps. Some interesting Scientology history. We'll talk about a lady who got caught inside a Murphy bed, much to her dismay. Many, many weird stories. I like that tour a lot. East Side Babylon on March the 11th is perhaps my most unhinged crime bus tour. It was written so that I could tell the Radio Shop murders, which is a story so twisted and deranged that it even gives me the chills. And also, of course, so we can take people to the Giant Tamale, which is always a bit of a preservation crisis, but one of our favorite buildings in Southern California and a place you definitely want to see. And we'll take a nice little walk through Evergreen Cemetery to visit, yes, the Carnies, of which there are many. On Saturday, March 18th, it's Pasadena Confidential, a crime bus tour of the most refined portion of Southern California society, where, yes, bad things happen. You know, involving crazy millionaires and presidential assassins and rocket scientists and black magicians, all our favorite types of people. Hotel Horrors and Main Street Vice is on Saturday, March 25th. That one's filling up, so if you want to get on that bus, don't delay. We'll be poking around downtown L.A., visiting some incredible time capsule interiors and talking about some of the darkest tales of serial killing and Skid Row murders and heartbreak that you've ever heard. April the 1st, it's Echo Park Book of the Dead, one of our newer and more occasional crime bus tours. And it has a walk down Carroll Avenue and visits to some really bizarre crime scenes. The Man in the Attic, The Love Slave, and yes, Sister Amy Semple McPherson's beautiful house. Then, April 8th, you've heard all about it, and maybe you're even going to join us for Palos Verdes, Ancient and Modern. And the ancient is going to blow your mind, and I think the modern might too. And that's a nice long day out. And, you know, it's a good excuse to get down to the seaside and learn some stuff. We'd love to see you there. And then tax day? You've already turned your taxes in, right? Well, maybe it'll be Monday this year. In any case, April 15th, Saturday, it's the Real Black Dahlia, our most popular crime bus tour, following in the footsteps of Elizabeth Short, the victim in the still unsolved 1947 murder mystery that kicked off this whole esoteric adventure. So 10 years into it, we're still doing it, and we'd love to take you out on that bus. And remember, this sad, sad girl who we're all a little bit in love with around here, and we don't really think we're ever going to solve the case, but at least we can visit her with love and send people away knowing a little more about her than just, she was an actress who got in the wrong car. She wasn't an actress.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you, everyone at home, for listening. Continue to stay tuned. And remember,
you can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long lost neighborhood called Hermina, between South Pass and Highland. a gold mine.